Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. If you love digging into the week's political headlines, subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our reporters take you behind the scenes of some of the biggest stories from the campaign trail to the halls of Congress. Just for our Inside the Hive listeners, save 15% on a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair with promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off 1 year of all you can read, watch, and hear.
Welcome to Inside the Hive. I am your guest today, Nick Bilton. Some of you may remember my voice from the good old days. The ghost of Christmas present.
Present. And lucky we are for that.
How are you? What's that?
It's a bittersweet day.
It is.
For us on the Hive. Sweet and sweetest because you are here with us, and I'm so happy that you're here. I'm always happy to hear your voice and get to talk to you. I'm particularly happy to hear it today. It's a sad day for us at the Hive and in journalism and in the world. I'm going to try not to cry, but I might. We lost our beloved editor, John Homans, at the Hive on Wednesday evening, and we are heartbroken. I think that's fair to say. And Nick, you can speak to this as well, but John Homans was a true original. He was a force to be reckoned with. He was an editor unlike any editor I've ever had and unlike any editor I ever will have. He was a wordsmith, a magician, a cheerleader, a champion. He was not someone who was free with his attaboys and mushy and
definitely not.
but he was someone who was absolutely. I never had a doubt that he had my back. Every word that I wrote, he made better. Everything that he touched felt like he spun gold out of nothing, and he had such a taste for news, a phenomenal set of morals and principles, and he was not scared of anyone or anything, and it gave me so much courage to do what I want to do and to stand up to people who were trying to stifle me at various points or putting up roadblocks in the way of actually getting the story. And knowing that he had my back made me more fearless, and he made me a better writer and a better reporter and a greater thinker. And he was funny and kind and really, I've never really met anyone like him before. And this is sudden and sad and a huge hole that I don't think we'll ever really fill.
Yeah, it's and it was so sudden, and you know, he was 62, is that right?
62.
And you know, getting ready to retire in a couple of years and get a boat and a dog, and or maybe he already had the dog, but he was going to get the boat. And you know, it's just so shocking. I mean, you and I were talking before about you know, grounding this into kind of reality, because we've passed 150,000 deaths in the U.S. from coronavirus now. And that curve went in the complete opposite direction because of the leadership in this country, or the lack of leadership. And it's so, what's so heartbreaking is that, you know, at times like this, you want to be around your colleagues and the person who's passed away, their loved ones, and, you know, and kind of be able to attend a funeral, and you can't do that. And it makes it all the more difficult. And I think what brings it back to, you know, what I admired so much about John Homans was that he was, you know, if this was someone else, he'd have been like, let's do a story about that, you know? And, you know, he had these amazing kind of aphorisms that always seemed to kind of fit perfectly in the moment. So it's incredibly sad, and we'll miss him tremendously. And but I've learned more from him as an editor than I can say about you know, from almost anyone else I've worked with. So
I couldn't agree more. And I couldn't sleep last night. And didn't help that there was an earthquake in the middle of the night.
You couldn't sleep partially because of that and partially because there was an earthquake.
Well, in my brain, I'm like, so I was sitting there. I'm sure you've had this before, but I literally slept for 1 hour. And when you're in the middle of the night and you're just like, your brain hurts because you're so tired, but you can't sleep. And I'm like, I can't sleep. I'm tossing and turning. My puppy's in my bed and my fiance's snoring. And I'm like, oh God, I can't turn off my brain. And all of a sudden the room starts shaking. And I'm very new to Los Angeles. I've never been in an earthquake before. And I was like, is my brain exploding or is there an earthquake here? And I woke up my fiance and he's like, yeah, that's an earthquake. You crazy person. Go to sleep. But as I was up in the middle of the night going through this earthquake, I was getting angry. And I told you this before we started recording, but I'm sad and I'm angry because we are one of probably tens of millions, two of tens of millions of people in this country who are experiencing a life moment that in a normal sense, you and I would be on a plane to New York today and we would get to sit in a room with our colleagues and share memories and attend a funeral and hug each other. And because of the dearth of leadership at the top, we can't have moments like that that are very fundamental and very important. And I know that there are so many people in this country who are facing tremendous hardships. They are out of work. They are worried about Congress not extending unemployment benefits. There's concerns about the election coming, and there are major things that are impacting people. But there are also moments in life that I think are really important to mark. And someone dying is one of those moments. I got engaged, and I can't celebrate with my family. And I have friends who are having babies who are not going to be able to be with their parents when they're having babies. And it's so maddening to me because all of this was preventable if we actually had leadership in this country. And as we start talking about, for the rest of this conversation, we won't talk about us and our own sadness, but we will talk about what's happening in Washington. And for me, for the first time, you know, we talk about and we write about and we tweet about all the things that are happening in this country and how terrible they are and how much the pandemic has changed things. But it felt like the first moment where I was like, oh, this is fundamentally going to shape major moments in every person's life at this point. And we're having no guidance from the top about how to make this better for us. And if that's not a motivation to get to the polls in November, I don't know what is.
Not only is there no motivation, but you have Donald Trump who's tweeting about Fox News from Air Force One and then tweeting today that he believes that the, not believes, but, you know, he's making up bullshit statements, but that the election is going to be the most fraudulent in U.S. history and that maybe we should delay it. Thank God we can't delay it. He can't delay it at least. But yeah, it's just unfathomable, how much of a lack of leadership this country has today. I was talking to my sister who lives in Europe this morning and, you know, her kids were on the playground. I mean, that doesn't seem like a huge deal, but that you can't do that here. It's like, because of the way that they haven't done the right things around kind of battling this. And then also, I mean, I'm probably going to get a little annoyed here, but, Trump's new doctor, who's like a conspiracy theorist nut job.
He has amazing doctors. Let's just talk about this for a second. He has,
I mean,
the highest quality medical professionals. The doctor in New York with the long hair and the letter about his perfect health was, he's just perfect. He's just perfect. And then he had the White House doctor.
Yeah. Oh my God. No, the new one who claimed that we have alien DNA and that if Facebook doesn't allow her videos back online, that Jesus is going to be resurrected to destroy Facebook. I mean, I think that they should just not do it just to see what happens, because I'd like to see Jesus resurrected. It'd be kind of fun.
Stay tuned.
I mean, it is 2020, so if there's ever a time for that to happen, it would be now. But it's just insane. And yeah, all of it is insane. But I actually think, and this is a perfect segue, it is not just the moron in chief who is at fault here. It's Congress, and we saw that this week with the hearing, I guess you could call it, the spectacle that was on display for big tech, which was supposed to be asking the question of antitrust questions, but instead turned into a typical Republicans like, you're not fair to us, to the tech
companies. Can I ask you a question? So I hadn't tuned into it yesterday because I feel like, for me personally, I mean, I was a little bit distracted yesterday with what was going on, but also I feel like there was more important news that I'd rather focus my attention on. And then I was up in the middle of the night, and so I caught up on all the stuff that I had missed. It seems to me, and you tell me if I'm wrong, I'd rather you tell me I'm right, though, that Congress has no idea what goes on social media. Like, I'm pretty sure they've never used social media before, because the questions they ask are... it's like they've never turned on a phone or a computer before.
I think you just gave them too much credit. It's not that they don't know what happens on social media. I don't think that they understand what technology is. Like,
sure,
I'm sure that some of those senators are up there, like, get their tweets and their emails still printed out. I've even read that that's the case. And their facts are so wrong, it's not even funny. I follow Kevin Roos from the New York Times, has this new Facebook's top 10 Twitter account. And he's been doing this for quite a while, where he tweets the top 10 linked posts and page views on Facebook every day, or every few days, whatever. And it's insane. Like, here's today's. The top 10, Donald J. Trump, Don Bongino, the conservative lunatic, it keeps going. Occupy Democracy, Ben Shapiro, like, these are all Fox News. These are all the, like, Blue Lives Matter. These are the top linked sources every single day. It's like, once in a while there's a liberal point of view that kind of gets in there, but, like, literally, it's most of the time 10 out of 10 have things that are shared on Facebook are conservative. And so you've got these Republicans up there saying, you're unfair to us and you stifle our voices. Like, what the fuck are you talking about? Like, your voices are so unstifled. It's ridiculous. I mean, it's like, it's just total lunacy. And then you've got these other people that don't even know. Like, one of my favorite questions from the hearings was, when one of the senators attacked Mark Zuckerberg because Don Jr.'s tweet was
Don Jr. was kicked off Twitter.
Mark Zuckerberg was like, Mark Zuckerberg was like, I don't run Twitter, so you're kind of asking the wrong guy here. It's like, they're so busy. I mean, I literally was waiting for someone to, like, ask Jeff Bezos, like, why his Amazon Prime order hadn't showed up yet or something like that.
I mean, that would have been at least a useful question that they asked. Yeah.
This is Inside the Hive.
In the 1980s and 90s, New York City needed a tough cop like Detective Louis Scarsella.
Putting bad guys away, there's no feeling like it in the world.
He was the guy who made sure the worst killers were brought to justice.
That's one version.
This guy is a piece of shit.
Derek Hamilton was put away for murder by Detective Scarsella.
In prison, Derek turned himself into the best jailhouse lawyer of his generation.
And the law was my girlfriend. This is my only way to freedom.
Derek and other convicted murderers
started a law firm behind bars.
We never knew we had the same cop in the case.
Scarsella.
We gotta show that he's a corrupt cop.
They can go f*** themselves.
I'm Steve Fishman.
And I'm Dax Devlin Ross. And this is The Burden. Listen to new episodes of The Burden starting March 19th on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. And to hear episodes 1 week early and ad-free with exclusive content, subscribe to True Crime Clubhouse on Apple Podcasts.
As a reporter, anytime you interview a CEO, it actually tends up to be the worst interview that you could ever do, because they're so messaged and close to the vest and careful, and they've been coached into oblivion. And so actually these types of things tend to be quite boring because you have people who are professionally good at dodging questions. And so my view was, okay, well, here's going to be a couple of hours of CEO speak. And that's why I didn't really tune in. But it wasn't the CEOs that were disappointing or bad. It was the representatives who were horrible. This was a chance to ask questions of people under oath that these people are fundamentally changing the way that we interact as a society, the way that elections will be held, whether or not they will be fair, whether or not information is disseminated in a balanced way. And they totally blew it so that they could grandstand or they can make partisan claims. I would have rather watched all of them ask questions of each other, to be honest. Can you imagine Mark Zuckerberg getting to ask questions of Jeff Bezos, or, you know, the interplay amongst them would have been 50,000 times more interesting than these Republicans and Democrats who were either trying to make a political stand or having absolutely no idea what it means to use technology. It was just such a waste of everyone's time.
I completely agree. And I think, look, I think at the end of the day, you know, it's a start. Casey Newton, who writes for The Verge, has a great newsletter called The Interface, and he had a good piece kind of saying, you know, this is the beginning of something, and we're kind of, you know, while it was in many respects, there was some ridiculous moments and obviously more ridiculous moments from the Republicans and the Democrats, but it's the start of these kind of hearings, and we haven't seen these before, especially with these folks up on stage. And and I think that the problem is that, you know, technology moves so quickly these days. It's an exponential curve in which the speed of which it's changing, and the number of people who are getting onto these platforms, and how quickly one becomes. And, you know, Zuckerberg had a great point yesterday where he said, you know, I forget the timeline ago, but it was like a few, you know, 10 years ago, whatever it was, the top 10 richest companies had been the top 10 richest companies for decades. Wow. And now they only make three of the top 10 biggest companies today. And it's that has all changed in such a short period of time. And I think that what the problem is, and has always been the problem when it comes to government, is that government moves slower than the speed of technological change. And you know, they're addressing issues that I think should have been addressed 5, 6, 7 years ago, maybe even 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And when they finally do get around to enacting something, some sort of antitrust laws or whatever, and I do think that some of these tech companies actually want them. They want the guidelines so that they don't, you know, pass over them. But once they do that, there's going to be something else like AI or, you know, space travel or whatever the hell it is. It's that will impact, and, you know, all these different people. One thing that's so fascinating is there's this new technology that came out just a couple of weeks ago. It's called GPT-3 or GTP-3. I forget exactly, but it's a new AI interface for language. And so it actually uses machine learning, and it creates an interface that anyone can tap into where you can ask it questions, and it can formulate in complete sentences and respond. And you can use it almost like an API to build things for your site and so on. And people were playing around with it. And one of the sites I was exploring was where you could ask anyone a question. So you could ask Albert Einstein, like, explain to me like how you came up with the theory of relativity. And it searches the web, and it takes all the language, and it parses it and creates this kind of natural language processing version of a conversation. You can literally have a conversation with Einstein. You can have one with Donald Trump. And the answers like were so spot on in many respects. And then every once in a while, you would get some weird answers. Like from Trump, I was like, are you a racist? And he would respond
what was the answer?
AI version of him. Well, it changes based on like how you ask different questions each time. So if you ask a series of questions, but there was like some answer about like what is racism or something like that. So it turns, so I was like, oh, that's a little weird. So it turns out, I forget the exact answer, but it turns out that I was speaking to a friend who works in Silicon Valley, and they showed me a picture of all the people that have worked on this AI. And it's literally, I'm almost positive it's 100% white people. Mm. So you have this technology that you will start to see implemented into society in the next, I don't know how many years. It's from the OpenAI Institute. But it could be months, it could be days, it could be whatever. And it could affect God knows what. We have no idea how it's going to be used. And yet it is being created by people who have never had to deal with the things that people who are African-American have or so on. And I think that it's a, you know, Congress should be addressing that right now, but Congress doesn't know what that is. You know, it's like, and I think that that's where the main problem with all these companies and Congress comes into play, is that the technology is being created quicker. And as AI gets more advanced and chips get more advanced and we move into quantum computing and all these other things that will happen in our lifetime, it's just, it's going to outpace everything. And that's my biggest worry, honestly.
Well, you know, that's so fascinating because, first of all, obviously, especially at the top of all of these technology companies, there's really so little diversity, and there's, relatively speaking, so little diversity in Congress. I somehow doubt in both of those areas that kind of absence of a different voice is even registering. And when you think about, I never really thought about AI in this sense before. And every time I feel like you talk to me about AI, I'm like, what? I didn't even know that's possible. I feel like you just are in this space in a totally different and fuller way than I am. But if you think about how these tech companies are going about this, if they're primarily led by white men, then their first priority to me, I'm guessing, is let's get this done fast and let's get this done quick and let's get this done right. And they're not thinking about, well, whose voices are we telling and how are we telling these voices? And that is such an important conversation and such a vital one, to not really have women as part of that, to not have people of color as part of that, is such a gap and it's such a miss. And it's really what's been a problem with how history has been told over the last, you know, generations and generations and generations, and it's repeating itself in this next iteration of how we're going to be telling stories and disseminating information. And I think you're totally right that it's not even registering that you should be having different voices tell the stories and send out different kinds of information.
And I think at the end of the day, you know, like, do I think that these people who are running these companies are evil? Maybe a little bit. They you know, maybe, but I think that what is, you know, maybe they're not. Maybe they believe that they're making the world a better place. You know, who knows?
I'm sure they believe some of them that. Yes.
I think some of them are a little bit more, you know, I don't want to use the word sociopathic, but maybe a little bit. But they're a little bit more concerned with their own self-importance rather than that of humanity. Look, I mean, at the end of the day, Facebook and Google and Amazon and Apple employ, you know, a couple million people, sure, and give them jobs. And so we should, you know, they do a tremendous amount of good for the world. Like, you know, if it wasn't for smartphones and the invention of the iPhone and cameras and so on, we wouldn't have Black Lives Matter. No one would have seen George Floyd, you know, be murdered by four police officers.
Sure.
And so, so there's a tremendous amount of good that comes of it. But I think the problem is that, you know, it's that we are left, they are the ones deciding what society looks like, and we have very little power and say in how they change it. We can't change Mark Zuckerberg's decision to not kick, you know, Donald Trump off his platform when he lies, or hide his Facebook posts or whatever, you know, or to decide to go after, you know, white supremacists. Or we can't change, you know, Jeff Bezos's viewpoint on saying, well, we want to always be the biggest company in the world, so we're going to fuck every mom and pop store we can possibly imagine. Like, we just can't, we have no control over that. And I think
we have no ability to change their decision-making process, but we do have the ability to choose whether or not we are on a platform. And I think that part of the problem and part of the reason why it would have been so valuable to actually ask tough questions of them on Capitol Hill was that, sure, you and I can say, you know what, we're not going on Facebook anymore. We're going to delete Instagram too. And we're not going to shop from Amazon anymore. We're only going to shop from mom and pop stores. And that's what our focus is. And we're going to boycott these sites. But the reality is that they are so big and they occupy such a tremendous amount of the market share and the number of people who use these platforms that there really is no way to avoid them. And that's the thing that people, that representatives of Capitol Hill should be focusing on, that they are too big to get around. And you, if you are that big to get around, how are you not regulating them? That I think is what was a real missed opportunity yesterday.
This is Inside the Hive.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
So last night, I didn't get a lot of sleep either, partially because of the passing of John Homans, partially because I'm reading a book about the multiverse, and you know, went to bed realizing that there are, you know, potentially 2 trillion galaxies in the observable universe, and each galaxy has, you know, potentially hundreds of billions of stars, if not hundreds of millions, whatever. And we're just these
sounds
kind
like
of
some light bedtime
infinitesimal.
Reading,
I'm obsessed with quantum mechanics, and I can't stop reading about it. And
I'm
find
doing
it
is
so
watching Real Housewives. You're making me feel that.
Well, it's like Real Housewives, but
Real Housewives,
the Housewives
of the multiverse,
are galaxies.
Get on it, Bravo. Yes. Get on it.
So, so I go to bed thinking about this and like our place in this vast, open, endless thing that you know, and why, and then thinking about, you know, Homans passing away, and then there's this earthquake at 4:30 a.m. and then my dogs decided they thought that was wake up time.
Totally.
So that was it. And then I finally fell back asleep and there was another earthquake at like 6 a.m. Anyway, my point is, when I finally woke up because of the kids at 6:30 a.m. I guess you could call it woke up. I don't know. You got up, but
we may still be.
I looked at my phone, and the first thing was a news alert from where it had said Donald Trump tweeted that he thinks we should postpone the election. By the way, he can't. But then yesterday, RGB was in the hospital, and again, and like I literally like I almost had a panic attack from the moment I woke up, and. Barring the fact that I'm going to take a little break from my book tonight. I'm going to watch The Real Housewives of New York or whatever they call it. Never watched it before.
Bless.
But putting aside why we're here and all those existential questions and what happens when we die and how big the universe is and so on, are you a little nervous about how this is going to go down with the election? I mean, it's like in this little universe that we live in right now, on this planet, in this country – like shit could go pretty haywire pretty quick. I mean, we all, you know, keep saying 2020 is the worst year ever. 2020, it's like awful. And I think it could get much fucking worse, honestly.
Well, I would say there's no bottom to 2020. So I don't disagree with you there. But I'm not super worried about us not having an election and Trump. Like Trump can rant and rave about a lot of things. And he is the president. He has a lot of incredibly important powers. The ability to change the date of the election is not one of them. And so that of all the things is not my concern, though I am prepared to eat my words if something changes. I'll take full responsibility for my lack of foresight there if that happens, and I pray to God it does not. What I am worried about more than not having an election is that there is going to be cheating in this election. And if they did it in 2016 and it worked out so well for them, why wouldn't they do it again in 2020, right? Like, they have someone who, the Russians, that's what I mean by they, they have someone in office who has been a dear friend to them. And someone who will not criticize them publicly, someone who will not come out and talk about the bounties put on the heads of American soldiers, someone who will write love letters to dictators. And so, yeah, they're going to cheat. And every intelligence official who has a brain in their head and a conscience in their hearts has said as much. And so I'm not super worried about Trump making a decision. I'm way more worried about other people deciding to interfere in this election, how that's going to play out. And that's like that's on like the Russian side of it. I'm also so concerned about domestic voter suppression that we will have a huge effort by Republicans, by any number of groups, making sure that it is difficult for people who traditionally vote for Democrats to get to the polls, to cast a ballot. And it's just, it's so disheartening. I listened to John Lewis's funeral this morning, and President Obama gave a eulogy that really will make you nostalgic for a time past. And a large part of his eulogy was talking about how important it is to vote and to not suppress the vote and to make Election Day a national holiday to make sure that as many Americans can vote as possible. And it just, every week I feel like I say this on this podcast, but I will continue to say it. This is the number one issue that we should be focusing on, is how to really have a free and fair election. And a free and fair election means that there is the ability for every American to get to the polls unimpeded in November. And I'm just so worried about that happening.
I have a question I don't truly know the answer to, and I'm curious what you think. Why is it, so I vote by mail in every election, and there's been a couple where I haven't sent the envelope out in time, so I just go down to the place and I give them the ballot and that's it. And literally, don't even have to wait in line; you just hand it to somebody. And there's I remember when during the Hillary Trump election 2016, I actually didn't vote by mail because I wanted to. I thought it was going to be this historic moment, the first time I was voting for the first female president in history. And why do people not, why do more people not vote by mail? I don't get it. It's
because
such a
most states don't have vote by mail. California is an anomaly.
Is it the only?
I don't think it's the only state. I actually don't know the numbers, but California is not the only state, but it is by far the minority. So. I have voted in two states, in Pennsylvania and New York. I don't think in either case I was able to vote by mail. I know in Pennsylvania you're not able to vote by mail unless you're doing absentee balloting. I actually don't vote since I started covering.
I just looked it up. So before the pandemic, it was only five states: Colorado, Hawaii, Oregon, Utah, Washington. Right. Conducted their elections using a vote-by-mail system. Though all states allow voters to vote by mail in certain circumstances, before the pandemic, 16 required voters to provide reasons. So it is going to change, hopefully, because of the pandemic.
But all of that will have had to have happened a long time ago. We saw this in the primary process over the spring where, Republican legislatures in states were not allowing governors to say, hey, you can vote by mail in this special election because we're in extraordinary times, that there was a huge effort to block those sort of changes. And we're getting close to the election. Even if every state unanimously decided today, which will not happen, that they were going to allow vote by mail, it's a huge infrastructure to get that done. I mean, to make sure that you're able to send out enough ballots, that people are able to send them back, that you have the infrastructure to count them, that, I mean, we are in a historic time for the post office right now. The post office may run out of funding.
I know, that's its own story.
It's its own story. And by the way, it's not really its own story. It's a story that is very much, I think, connected. And I don't think it's an accident that a Republican administration and a Republican-run Congress is is not behind giving more people access to voting, and particularly working people access to vote. And it's so scary. It's so important. And I urge everyone to do something about it, call your representatives, to donate money, to figure out a way to have everyone's voices heard in this election. It is the most important election of a lifetime. And however you're going to vote, that is your decision, and that's a sacred decision, and that's a decision that many people have fought for throughout the course of our country. But everyone should have the right to at least raise their voice and cast a ballot, and that is central to who we are as a country and a people, and that should just be a real major focus as we head toward November.
This is Inside the Hive.
So I have a couple questions for you before we go.
Yeah.
The first question is, it's on this topic. I'll tell you the second question so you can think about it. The second question I'm going to ask you is who you think the VP nominee is going to be for Biden, and what you think about that whole process. Yeah. But before we get there, how do you think this plays out? Let's just say, like, there is I do have this theory that, you could literally take an orange or a banana and put it on the ballot next to Donald Trump, and I'm voting for the banana. Like, it's just with glee, I will happily do it. Mm. You could pretty much put, I think, anyone on the ballot other than Mitch McConnell and maybe Mike Pence and maybe Getz and maybe Jim Jordan. There's a lot of people you could put on the ballot I wouldn't vote for. But I'm pretty much, it doesn't matter. I'm voting against Donald Trump. I think he's a diabolical person. That being said, my theory is that there's a world in which, you know, Biden stays in the polls above where he is. And again, the polls,
polls.
I think we hate the polls. Mm-hmm. But let's pretend for in our hypothetical universe, in this multiverse universe that we're in today, he stays above in the polls 10, 12 points, and we get to the debates, which are, I believe, late August, early October, is that right?
Who knows? Yeah.
And around then. And he, you know, makes a fool of himself on stage and slurs and whatever and so on. And Trump then will win. Okay, so that's scenario one. Scenario two is that he doesn't and Trump loses. Do you think Trump just goes? Do you think he's just like, peace, I'm out? Like,
I talked about this with Joe last week, and the more I think about it, the more I think I'm right. So that always feels good. And again, if I'm wrong, you heard it here first. I think that Trump doesn't want to be president. I think he sees the dollar signs for Trump TV. I think he can smell that money. And I think if he loses, it's just going to mean major, major money for him. Coming in, coming everywhere. And I think that that is way more appealing to him than having to serve 4 more years in office. I really do. And so I think if he loses, it's almost like it's energizing for the business that he's going to start.
Yeah, but if he doesn't want to win, then why is he tweeting stuff like,
I think he wants to win.
Got it.
I don't think he wants to serve. And so, but I think that the alternative, like, losing and staying is not appealing to him, because the part of the equation of winning and staying that he's attracted to is the winning. If he loses, he doesn't want to stay. He wants to go out and use the vitriol that his base will feel to fund his life for the remainder of his years on this universe. So I think that I mean, smart people who know him very well think that he may put up a fight. I don't see it. I really see him using, if there is a loss, using it to catapult his third act in the
Trump TV live 24 hours a day on every channel imaginable, coming to you from Satan's tower.
I hope there's a multi-universe. I hope there's a multi-universe.
All right, let's, I hope there's
Wait, okay, so VP, who's your thought?
Yep. Susan Rice.
Oh, interesting. You're not alone. People are abuzz about the Susan Rice possibility.
You know, it's interesting that there's a, you know, Kamala, I think she's a, you know, she's a politician. I think she'd be great. I think she would pick some issues. She would go after them. I think the reality is that let's just say Biden wins, whoever is the VP is going to be the nominee in 4 years. I don't think he's going to want to do more than one term. I don't think he's going to be capable. I don't actually know if he'll be capable of doing a full term. Mm-hmm. My big worry with Kamala is that, there are already people in the like Biden campaign that are apparently, I was reading some stories yesterday, that are out there putting in, leaking negative stories about her because they don't like her.
Here's what I'll say. It's not because they don't like her. The things that were released yesterday, that were reported on yesterday, were allies of Vice President Biden saying they worried that if he picks her, the second that he takes office, she's going to be gunning for her own 2020 run. They don't not like her. They don't like women in power. It was the most sexist trope that I've heard in 2020. An ambitious woman to many people is the most dangerous thing. And Kamala Harris is an ambitious woman. And by the way, the notion that someone dare think about their own political prospects when they're in the second most powerful position in the United States, how dare she have vision for her own future when she's in this high powered important role?
It is so sick to me.
I'm so mad about it. I'm glad that we got here because it boiled my blood
yesterday.
I'm not
disagreeing with you on any of that. I'm just saying that there are people out there who are, it's like when Kerry was picking mm-hmm. his VP nominee, you know, he was like, he kind of held his nose and went with Edwards, right? Sure. And, Bush picked Quayle. Like, it's like there are, I was looking at, I think Politico had this, site where they've put all the like ratings of how people feel about the VPs and if they like them or dislike them or this, that, and the other. And I think that what was so interesting was, you know, with some people there's this huge gap where they just don't, you know, they have no idea who these people are, right? You know, like, and their favorability, like Stacey Abrams, she had a 37% never heard of her gap and
right.
a 22% favorable view and a 20% unfavorable. So it's like pretty, you know, it was all kind of canceled itself out. You know, Tammy Baldwin, same thing. It was 11%, 13%, and 60% had never heard of her. And like, and you get to Kamala and a lot of people had heard of her, but for some reason, and I don't know what that reason is, she had a very high 34% unfavorable view, 20% hadn't heard of her. And whereas, you know, Susan Rice or, you know, some others who did have the people did know who she was, it was a lot less. It was 22% or something like that. And I think so that was my only worry. Like, I think that honestly, he's made a commitment to pick a woman, which is incredible. I think he's, based on the recent events that have happened, it's almost certain he's going to pick a woman of color, which is incredible. And all I'm saying is that I want him to pick the person who's going to help him win. I said this about the election in the beginning. Like, I was hoping that we would pick the person who was going to definitively beat him. We don't know if we've done that yet. But at the end of the day, that's to me what it comes down to.
I think that is sound. I think the reality is that Vice President Biden's commitment to put a woman on the ticket is historic. It's important, and it's going to be problematic because a large swath of this country is still incredibly sexist and more sexist than anyone would care to admit. And I think that will be a draw for many women. It will be a detractor for those people who do hold on to sexist views that are relics from the past. Hopefully they stay in the past. And this will be the last time we have this conversation in a presidential election going forward, from my mouth to God's ears. I have one last question for you before I let you go today.
To end that thought, I think at the end of the day, you're right and completely. And it's insane that is the reality. But I think that at the end of the day, what we have to hope for is that enough people are willing to vote for a banana versus Donald Trump, and that's all it's going to come down to.
And a banana and the first female vice president. Yes. That's exciting. That's yes. that. It's yes, not totally. President. It's I'm historic. Excited. It's progress.
Yes.
And
I'm just saying what I'm saying when I say that in a joking way. I mean that they saying. Can put aside any stupid thing that they have about any. You know, just these moronic viewpoints they still have from like the 1800s, and just realize that what's most important, because this is what the Republicans do. They like that, you know, some of them don't like guns, and some of them don't like abortion, and some of them don't like this, that, and the other. But they're like, I'm gonna get behind this guy because he does like the thing that I like, and I'm, you know, I think that's
sure. Anyway, sure. Well, here's the reality. This is the one question everyone has to ask. There are two questions, right? Here are the two questions that I would say to anyone going to the polls. We're in the middle of a pandemic. We are, as Americans, banned from entering Europe, our greatest allies, because of the place that we are in this world. We have tens of thousands of people who have died from the coronavirus just 6 months into this. Millions have been infected. We have no rapid testing. We have no real progress that I see being plausible to have a vaccine on the near horizon. We are in the middle of an economic downturn that may lead to a depression. We are the laughingstock of the world when it comes to our foreign policy decisions. We are probably not going to have free and fair elections. So my first question is, do you like the direction we're headed? And my second question is, are you better off than you were 4 years ago? And those are the only two questions. And if the answer is, I don't like the direction that I'm headed and I'm not better off, then it shouldn't really matter who's on the other end of the ticket, right? Because you don't like where we're going. If you're happy, then you know who to vote for. That's my thought leading into the election. I have one last question for you, Nick.
Yes, do it.
What is bringing you joy this week?
What is bringing me joy this week?
I feel like we had a really heavy conversation. I just need some light. Give me light. I'll start off, and then you can follow.
Okay.
We have a pizza oven, and we just installed a pizza oven, and we can't wait to have you socially distance in the backyard to bring your sourdough starter to make some sourdough pizza dough for us. But it's nice to, I know last week on the podcast I talked about our garden, and we're just really doubling down on everything in our backyard because we're never going anywhere. And it feels really nice to be able to pick things from our garden, to start a fire in a pizza oven in our backyard and just do something that feels like we're creating. That's my joy of the week.
I'm very excited about your pizza oven too, because I've been trying to be a little healthy. So my sourdough starter's been in the fridge for a month, and I'm gonna bring it out and we'll resurrect it just to make a pizza. One of my first jobs in high school was I was a pizza guy. I made pizzas. I was pizza delivery, and then I learned how to make the pizzas, and then I learned how to throw them.
What was your specialty?
Garlic knots, honestly.
Whoa.
But I loved garlic bread. I make a pizza, like a flat pizza, with this olive oily garlic herb thing that's
crispy
and delicious. So I'm very excited about that. I'm very excited. I got some new chocolate covered almonds.
Ooh.
These are the things.
I mean, it's the little things, Nick.
It's the little things. But I'm excited to hang out. You know, I mean, I think what's been really amazing about quarantine, quite honestly, is like the amount of time we all get to spend together, family-wise. And you've met my children. One is 3 and one is 5. And the 5-year-old just started to ride a 2-wheel bike.
Wow.
Which is very cool.
That's and I didn't no actually joke. Even,
what's really cool about it is he doesn't learn things in a traditional way. He learns them by watching. So like I've taught like other family members how to ride a bike, and like, you know, you like they fall off and you hold the back and they're like leaning from one side to the other, and like it's a process. It takes like weeks sometimes. And with him, he just kept watching kids do it. And then when we finally got to the park last weekend to do it, I stood behind him and I was like, all right, you're gonna fall, whatever, and he just took off, and that was it. Like literally, didn't teach him. Yeah,
what an
wild.
Interesting so, observation to make about how he learns. That's incredible.
How he learns.
Like, I also need you to teach me how to ride a bike. I know how to ride a bike, but I've told you this before. the expression that it's like riding a bike. I had not ridden a bike for a really, really long time. And then my fiance, then boyfriend, took me on this very like romantic first date in Los Angeles. It was the first time I came to visit him in LA. And he took me for a bike ride from Venice Beach to Manhattan Beach, which is, it's not a short bike ride. And I hadn't gotten on a bike for like probably 16 years, maybe more. It was a fucking disaster. And I was very angry at all the people who had used the expression, it's just like riding a bike, because that's not something that you can just pick right back up again.
You also didn't wear sunscreen, so...
Oh, I had the worst sunburn of my entire life on my hands. I took a red eye back to New York after this really lovely weekend. I had the worst sunburns on my hand that I took the red eye, I landed and went straight to my dermatologist's office to get steroid cream because my hands were like... 17 times the size and redder than any That's red amazing. I've ever seen in my life. So, Nick, your next job is to bring sourdough starter to make these garlic knots and also teach me how to re-ride a bike.
Yes. And this weekend, my son now, what's cool is when they hit five, you can like actually, your interests start to align. So, we've been watching skate videos and surf videos on YouTube and bike people doing bike tricks, and so now he wants to learn how to ride downstairs, and so that's the next challenge. So it's super fun.
Well, that's great.
So there you go.
That's a great bit of joy, and just a reminder to hug everybody tight and to tell everyone that you love them, and onwards and to next week and to the election.
As John Holmans would always say. Down the road we go.
Down the road we go. That's right. Nick, thank you as always.
Thank you.
I love having you on here. Everyone's happy to have you back, and particularly this week.
Of course. My pleasure. Great chatting.
Thank you to my guest, Nick Bilton, and my co-host, Joe Hagan, who will be back next week. If you enjoyed this conversation, please be sure to listen and subscribe to other great episodes of Inside the Hive. You can find those on Apple Podcasts, radio.com, or anywhere you get your podcasts. And don't forget to leave a review when you're there. Thanks to the folks at Cadence 13 for their production work. And of course, thanks to my sponsors. Please be sure to support them any way you support this podcast. We will see you next week.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.